Did you know that Nika AATC offers self-paced online courses on a growing range of topics aimed at helping you improve health outcomes for people with HIV? These interactive courses can typically be completed in about an hour and cover multidisciplinary topics such as smoking cessation in people with HIV, geriatric assessment and integration and models of care, managing difficult behaviors in HIV care settings, and using Zoom as a virtual workspace. Self-paced online courses are offered on Rise, Nika AATC's online learning platform. Courses are designed for healthcare providers providing patient care for people with HIV, including physicians, physician assistants, nurses, pharmacists, case managers, outreach workers, and other disciplines. To explore online courses for HIV care professionals, navigate to www.nikaatc.org/rise-courses. That's www.nikaatc.org/RISE-courses, or click the link in the podcast episode description. Welcome to Nika in the Know, a podcast for healthcare providers in the HIV field. I'm Mariana Breitman. Today, I'm sitting down with John Farragon to talk about the updates to the perinatal guidelines. Welcome again, John.
Thanks, Mariana. Happy to be here again.
So let's just get right into it. What can you tell us about these updates?
Yeah, so sure, Mariana. So these are a little bit dated. So right now we're in April of 2024, and these guidelines are actually updated in January of 2024. So a few months ago, but I think with the CROI updates and some of the other things we've been covering in the last few months, we hadn't had a chance to review these yet. But these, I think, are important for people listening today. Just a reminder that these are the DHHS guidelines. Again, this is just some of the highlights. I encourage you to take a look at the full version for some more detailed information on this topic. So one of the first things to talk about is PrEP. So obviously, PrEP is HIV prevention. So a few things that were highlighted. I think the one of the most important things is that given the lack of data, the episodic or non-daily PrEPs, this is a kind of the on-demand data, is not recommended for protection against vaginal exposure to HIV. So this is not, this is not, I think, rocket science. I think this is pretty straightforward. I think people know this, that on-demand PrEP was really only studied extensively in men having sex with men and transgender women as well who were engaging in anal sex. So this was not done in females, and so daily PrEP is really the way to do this. Also, as a little reminder, the TAF-FTC, which is the tenofovir alafenamide with emtricitabine, that's the newer version of PrEP that some patients are on. Just be aware that this is not approved for females. It was never approved for women that are engaged in cisgender women who engage in vaginal sex. So that's something just to make sure that people are aware of, right? There are some ongoing studies called the PURPOSE study. The PURPOSE 1 study actually is looking at TAF-FTC compared to lenacapavir. We should see data from that maybe at the end of this year or early next year. But at this point, this is not approved that way. And then obviously the TDF-FTC, which is the tenofovir disoproxil fumarate with emtricitabine, that's the older version of PrEP. That's approved pretty much for everybody. And you can also use that for on-demand use, especially only in MSM and in transgender women engaged in anal sex. For people who are planning to discontinue daily oral PrEP, this sometimes comes up too, Mariana. Like, how long do you tell people to continue to take it if they've had HIV exposure or they've had unprotected sex recently? How long do you tell them to stay on the PrEP, but they're going to stop it? So we usually tell them 7 to 28 days. Just realize that the 28-day point is probably makes the most sense because it really aligns with recommendations for post-exposure prophylaxis, and that's probably going to be your best strategy, I think. So I think these are important little pieces that were kind of discussed, at least around some of the initial data around PrEP.
Can you talk a little bit about PrEP before, during, and around pregnancy?
Yeah, so this is also an important piece of the guidelines, and this was actually, some of these sections were updated a little bit too, but for people who become pregnant, while they're receiving PrEP, including drugs that are not yet approved for PrEP during pregnancy, for example, long-acting injectable cabotegravir, and even the tenofovir alafenamide, emtricitabine, which you mentioned before, Clinicians are strongly encouraged to register them with the Antiretroviral Pregnancy Registry. So the APR, the pregnancy registry, is really, really important. And as early as you can in pregnancy as possible to get them registered. I know this is often forgotten, and it's also a lot of work too, because they do send you information and they request information about the patient and the regimen, but we still have a pregnancy registry. And it really helps us to identify possible issues with medications, most importantly, that are used for HIV during pregnancy. And also more, I think, its usefulness in ruling out toxicity is really, really key and providing, I think, real safety data in kind of real life patients. So the efficacy studies that have evaluated this TAF-FTC, as I mentioned before, has not been completed. So, we'll have to see what those purpose studies look like. So the panel actually has a formal do not recommend TAF-FTC for this population, including those patients who may be pregnant and postpartum. And then the TDF-FTC, which is the older version, the PK data really can't be extrapolated to the TAF-FTC. So that's the reason why we kind of mentioned earlier that this is not something that's approved, and it actually is in the guidelines, is do not recommend this TAF-FTC. So making sure that people who do become pregnant, if they while they're on PrEP, make sure to register them with the registry, which is the www.apregistry.com is the website, and making sure that they're not on TAF-FTC is really going to be an important part of what we should be doing for females, for women who may potentially need HIV prevention medications.
What if a pregnant person without HIV wants to use PrEP?
Yeah, so this is an important question. So basically, to prevent HIV infection, the guidelines do recommend that healthcare providers discuss PrEP with all sexually active people without HIV, including those who are trying to conceive. So if somebody's in front of you and they tell you that they're trying to conceive and trying to get pregnant, but they also have significant risk, PrEP really should be offered to those individuals who desire PrEP or have specific indications for PrEP. So I want to make sure everybody's very clear. Pregnancy on its own should not be a reason to withhold PrEP from patients, especially if they are asking for it. And if the partner of someone who's living with HIV, they should also be offered PrEP. So let's say you have what we call serodiscordant couples, right, where the partner is not infected with HIV and the other partner is. Those the serodiscordant couple, the one who's negative, who's HIV negative, are not identified as living with HIV. They should be offered PrEP, and especially if they request it again. Although U equals U, this whole undetectable is you can't transmit HIV if you're undetectable, is an important piece, and that certainly helps with these stories and what the in these situations. There may possibly be periods of non-adherence during pregnancy, so to be completely safe, we always try to recommend PrEP for those patients if the patients are willing to do it. And it may be really important for some of these serodiscordant couples that come in and request PrEP.
What about the HIV therapy for people trying to conceive?
Yeah, so this data, Mariana, are really not, there's not a lot of available data about the efficacy and safety of injectable CAB and rilpivirine during pregnancy. These injectable options have become more popular recently. So for those who are considering switching regimens prior to conception to prevent fetal exposure, it is important to recognize that CAB and rilpivirine injections must be stopped at least 1 year before conception to ensure that these long half-life drugs are fully eliminated. And this is actually discussed in the guidelines. This may sound kind of excessive, but it's really based just on how long the half-lives are of these meds after stopping therapy. So among those on long-acting injectable ART who've had a history of poor adherence to oral medications and they're switching from long-acting injectable CAB and rilpivirine to oral ART, that's really what they should do to prepare for conception, may be associated with the increased risk of viral rebound and NNRTI resistance. So always remember that why the person switched and the potential risk involved. And I think this whole idea of shared decision making really should be used when making decisions about changing to an oral regimen. I think it's going to depend on the patient. I will say this though, I mean, we don't know this for sure, but I think most people would agree that cabotegravir is likely okay in pregnancy. We just don't have enough data yet. And rilpivirine, we used a lot during pregnancy back in the day as a drug called rilpivirine TAF-FTC. That combination tablet was used often during pregnancy. But again, the injectables, we just don't know yet. So again, just a word of caution, and just again, the guidelines really recommend that they stop these drugs prior to conceiving, prior to trying to conception to make sure that those long half-life drugs are fully eliminated. So really kind of complex around this pregnancy issue for people who might be on long-acting injectables.
Now, what are some of the regimens we can use in pregnancy?
Yeah, so this comes up a lot, and I mean, we try to kind of follow the guidelines as best we can. But I think for pregnant people who are antiretroviral naive, the most people I think dolutegravir-based regimens are going to be preferred as initial ART. Now, just as a background, I want to make sure that people know that there was this old study with it's called it's it was the Botswana study looking at dolutegravir in patients who were pregnant, and they found there was an increased risk of what they thought was dolutegravir-associated neural tube defects. And I want to make sure that whole study has been kind of put to bed about those issues. And what happened was they had a significant number of cases in a short period of time. And so the FDA and I think even the World Health Organization was worried about dolutegravir pregnancy. So they put kind of a hold on that use. And then over time, they had more births that occurred. And as that denominator increased, basically the risk kind of went away. And so there's no increased risk of dolutegravir. So if you happen to read something that might be like 5 or 6 years old, you might see something about dolutegravir not using it in pregnancy, but that's changed in the last couple of years. So dolutegravir plus TDF or TAF plus FTC or lamivudine is probably what most people would do. You could also do dolutegravir plus abacavir 3TC. Again, that's one of our combination pills that we have available. That would only be for people who are HLA-B5701 negatives. That's the test that you need to rule out abacavir hypersensitivity. And those without chronic hepatitis B infection, co-infection would also be a concern about with using abacavir. And people with a history of CAB exposure for PrEP, I think that's where you kind of have to think differently. So just remember that for cabotegravir, if you're using that for PrEP, the concern is that if you switch people right away, that the concern might be that they might have cabotegravir resistance if they happen to break through and they acquired HIV. So most people would probably use a ritonavir-boosted darunavir regimen those are preferred for initial ART due to concerns about that integrated strand transfer resistance mutations, which again would be a very rare event. But I think just during that initial time period, before you had a baseline resistance test, I think you'd have to argue to use a ritonavir-boosted PI if somebody's had a history of CAB exposure for PrEP recently. Darunavir plus ritonavir plus TDF-FTC or FTC-3TC or darunavir-ritonavir plus abacavir-3TC, that's going to be, again, for only for those HLA-B5701 negative patients without HBV infection. And then just so you know that I think darunavir-ritonavir used to be preferred for use in pregnancy. This has now been bumped down to an alternative rather than a preferred regimen. And then also the one thing that's important too is that these revisions were made really to manage manages there was revisions to the section that about managing lack of viral suppression and virologic failure. And those guidelines do not recommend adding single ARV drugs to a virologic failing regimen, which I think we all know this, like not to add one drug, but it specifically spells it out now in the guidelines. So I think that's an important piece too for these updates.
This has been a lot of information. What else do pregnant patients or non-pregnant patients wanting to conceive need to know?
Yeah, so I think some new data in pregnancy that looked at the PK in pregnancy and the updated information on the APR, and it's all based on some of these data sets. Bictegravir is now recommended as an alternative ARV for use in pregnancy and for people who are trying to conceive. And I think many of you who are out there who are practicing, I think there is a lot of bictegravir use that's out there. You know, it I think for treatment naive patients for rapid start, I think that's what most people use. You don't have to, but I think that's what most people do. And it was previously categorized as insufficient data to recommend, but there are some limited data now, but no safety concerns so far have been observed. And but please know that given the wide use of this medication, it's not preferred, and it's really an alternative at this point. And I think and again, the darunavir ritonavir, which used to be preferred, is now an alternative to pregnancy people who are trying to conceive. And pregnant people with a history of CAB exposure, darunavir would be preferred there just because of CAB exposure due to concerns about insulin resistance, which I think would make sense to listeners. But I think the point here is that bictegravir is an alternative. This might change your approach when you have somebody who may be on bictegravir and maybe become pregnant, and then you discover that. And the question is, do you switch them? And some people might, you know, as a purist, you really probably should switch the dolutegravir plus TAF FTC or TDF FTC. You know, some people may consider, you know, continuing on BIC, but again, that's all an alternative. It's not a preferred regimen. So make sure you're very clear on what you're doing in those patients, making sure you're following guidelines as best you can. And making sure, I think, in a lot of ways, to discuss this with patients too, you know, that might be safer or not necessarily safer, but it might be, you know, more guideline driven to switch to another regimen that to a dolutegravir-based regimen, for example, instead of continuing BIC. And again, I think everybody's approach to that would be different, and I think different providers would do different things. But I think the other thing too is that we talk a lot about azacitidine back in the day as a recommended option in non-pregnant adults, but the ritonavir, just a reminder, it does require twice daily dosing in pregnancy, especially in later in pregnancy, and that dosing frequency really does affect ARB adherence. So I think if you can use an integrase-based regimen, I think that's really the key, and do your best to probably avoid ritonavir if you can. Again, except in some of the settings where it's preferred. And then some actually would use azacitidine ritonavir because it is once a day. But again, you know, that's something that would be patient specific that a provider would have to decide and talk to the patients about.
As we begin to wrap up, what other resources and the guidelines are helpful for our listeners to know about today?
Yeah, so yes, so I would encourage providers to look at the Appendix B and C in the guidelines in this section. Appendix B is a great section on safety and toxicity in pregnancy. And then the Appendix C is a section on ARV counseling for healthcare providers. This is really good. It can help you provide proper counseling for patients. And these can really be helpful if you have a patient who is pregnant, requiring ARV treatment, and you're trying to figure out what to do. And I think it's an important piece of what you can offer to patients as far as counseling. So I hope this is all helpful, Marianne. I know it's a lot. It's just a highlight of some of the new changes to this guideline, but I encourage people to look at the DHHS guidelines. You know, again, this section is that was recently updated in January to get some new information on kind of the perinatal updates that have occurred from DHHS.
John, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the latest from the DHHS pregnancy guidelines. We really hope you learned something new today. To learn more about NICA AATC's work and our role in ending the HIV epidemic, visit us at www.nicaaatc.org. That's www.necaaatc.org. If you have questions or comments about anything we covered today, or if you have suggestions for topics you'd like to hear us talk about, don't hesitate to email us at podcast@nicaaatc.org. That's podcast@nicaaatc.org. Stay safe, and we'll see you on Thursday for our next episode of NICA in the Know. This presentation is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by, HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government.